Just got my phone on for a backup. This is Dan McCarthy. It is December 1st, 2015. I'm here interviewing Dr. William Martin McLean. And I'm going to get started with talking to you about when you first came to the area. You originally went to Berkeley?
Yes. After graduate school, I went to Cambridge, England.
Okay.
And on a National Science Foundation scholarship or fellowship. And I stayed almost 2 years in Cambridge. And from there, I went straight to Berkeley, California. In those days, you could get a job by just writing a letter. And so without ever even being interviewed at Berkeley, I appeared there as a young faculty member.
Okay.
And I started teaching right away in physical chemistry and in, of course, we all rotated into the freshman program, so they had plenty of professors at Berkeley. People were actually felt honored to be asked to teach the freshmen because it gave them something to do other than research. So, yes, I spent a number of years at Berkeley, and about 7 years, and I did not get tenure there, so I was out on the job market just at a time when the job market was beginning to dry up. I was born in 1938, which means that as I approached college age, we had the Sputnik event. And everyone was afraid that we were going to fall behind the Russians. And so people who wanted to major in science got many perks in those days, things that just don't exist anymore. And I don't know how I would have ever had my education without some of them. I was a National Carbide Scholar at Rice University. And of course, in those days, Rice was called Rice Institute. And it had no tuition whatsoever.
Wow.
Tuition was free, just like they want to make it now. Only, of course, it was on the basis of a great deal of endowment, basically from oil-soaked land in East Texas that Rice owned. And so I got through my whole undergraduate training at Rice without ever paying a penny of tuition, just some fees and of course the housing. But Union Carbide paid that for me. So basically I got a free college education. And then I went to Cornell University for graduate school. And there again I had a position that, as a teaching assistant that paid my way. So I never really accumulated any debt or any, I mean, it was a charmed life in those days. But the charm sort of came to an end about the time I had to leave Berkeley. There were no jobs to speak of around the country. I wrote, 50 or 100 letters and got very few replies. But I had one good friend here. His name was Ed Lem. He was in the chemistry department at Wayne State. And it turned out that one of their faculty members here had been murdered.
Oh, wow.
Yes, he was. His name was Livingston. Okay. And he was a physical chemistry professor. So it was a very nasty street crime in his neighborhood that killed him. So Wayne State was looking for a new physical chemistry professor. Ed Lim knew me, and I was invited to come here for an interview, and so I ended up at Wayne State in 1973, but you can check that from my CV, which you have.
Was it a difficult choice to come here?
What?
Was it a difficult choice to come to Detroit after that?
Oh, no, not at all. It was the only job offer I had. It was, and it turned out to be really a very, very fortunate and good choice. Wayne State supported me quite well here, and I have no complaints about the department or anything. Mm-hmm. It was not Berkeley, but it was not bad either.
Did you have any notions of Detroit before you moved here?
I'd been here once before, at least, when I was just passing through in my car. Mm-hmm. And I remember already Detroit was beginning to decline a little bit. Mm-hmm. And this must have been in the late 60s, I guess. I remember seeing grass growing in the streets in certain places. But I remember also visiting the Art Institute and being, you know, extremely impressed with it. I was just a guy in a car with all his possessions in the back seat traveling through the country. And I think I was going home after being in Ithaca for a while. I was probably going home for a Thanksgiving vacation or something like that. And I stopped in Detroit, and so I had some knowledge of what Detroit was. Mm-hmm. Was you know, a huge city, but people were predicting that it would decline. So little did they know.
So did you have any thoughts about the murder that happened before you moved here?
Well, I thought I would try to avoid that. But yeah, it Livingston had gotten into a neighborhood feud with some kids that were very aggressive. They stole his TV set 4 or 5 times. Finally, he bolted the TV set to the floor so that they couldn't lift it. And when they had discovered that, they came to his door, rang the doorbell, and he answered the door, and somebody thrust a knife into him.
Oh, wow.
Just as he opened the door. So I thought it was a good idea not to get into neighborhood feuds.
Yeah, that absolutely. Yeah. Did you move right to the Cass Corridor when you moved here?
No, we lived in Pleasant Ridge for a year. We lived, John Oliver was on sabbatical, and we lived in his house.
All right.
Professor John Oliver, later dean.
And was it during that time you were looking for houses?
Yes, we knew we didn't want to stay in Pleasant Ridge. And I also knew that I would prefer to walk to work. Mm-hmm. So we were quite amazed to find the West Canfield Historic District, which was not in good shape, but it had some activity. Mm-hmm. There was a lady who was sort of the spark plug Historic District. Her name was Beulah Groen, G-R-O-E-H-N, and she was on the phone all day long every day, talking to city council or the police or the fire department or the lighting department or whoever needed to work on Canfield Street. And through her activity, Canfield really began to look pretty attractive. Mm-hmm. as a future possibility. And I'm pleased to say that everything that she was trying to work for has pretty much come to pass.
Yeah.
It's just in the last few years, you know, we've had this amazing renaissance of entrepreneurial investment in the neighborhood. But the first real investment in this part of town was really at Canfield Street. Mm-hmm. We were not the only people who bought a house and had enough money to take a house that was basically scheduled for the bulldozer and put it back into livable condition. So we bought the house for an incredible house and property for an incredibly low price. It would the whole for this large block with 3 buildings on it. We paid $25,000, and we sort of bought, with my father's help, we just bought out the land contracts and owned it outright, which was, I think, really good advice from my father, who was a lawyer and didn't like land contracts at all. So we did own the property outright, and we put what we thought was an enormous amount of money back into it, maybe probably another $25,000, getting the house livable and putting in new windows, making it heatable again, mm-hmm. basically. It was the way we found it, it was not heatable, and there were, the first time I saw this house, there was a small river of water running down the front stairs from a radiator that had frozen and broken upstairs.
Oh, wow.
And I don't know why I didn't turn around and walk out, but I guess it was because we saw some beautiful wood and we liked the design of the house, and it looked like if we fixed that radiator, we wouldn't we wouldn't have the river down the trickle of water down the stairs anymore. And so all that came to pass. We fixed that radiator, the very first thing, of course, and then the roof, and then the windows, and made it livable, at least for us. We had a dog and two young daughters, and the dog wouldn't come in the house unless we built a fire. He knew it was cold in there. Yes, so. But within a year or two, we were living reasonably comfortably in that house.
Mm-hmm. How long had it been abandoned before you bought it, you know?
At least a year. When we bought it, it had been a kind of a flop house for vagrants, basically. We moved out about 12 mattresses that were on the floor and 3 pool tables.
Oh, wow. That's been a lot of work.
So it was, and a whole bunch of folding chairs, because the house had been used as a church. It had belonged to the Central Detroit Baptist Church. Oh. And the house became the minister's house, and it has large rooms downstairs. At first they just had enough folding chairs that they held their services downstairs, but it soon outgrew that, and they built a third structure behind the house, a church. However, it looks like a concrete block warehouse. It doesn't have a steeple or anything like that. The one thing it had was a pool in the middle of the front floor, of the front of it, where you could fill it with water and do full dip immersion baptisms. And there was a piece of, there was some kind of covering for that, but so you didn't see it when it wasn't in use. But when we saw it, it was half filled with water, most disgusting stuff in it floating around. You know? So that was one of the things we had to do, was pump it out and get it dry.
Did you keep the outbuilding up?
Yes, we did, for a time. It was in fairly good shape. It was in much better shape than the house when we first bought it. And then aside from the church, which was in the middle of the backyard, at the very back of the backyard, there was a carriage house of historic style, which had originally been the carriage house for the people who lived in the front house mm-hmm. there. So it had room. It was a stable for at least 2 horses. And originally, when we saw it, it had been totally gutted, and so actually we have not done anything with the carriage house, and now it's badly in need of rescue itself, and we will probably do that at some point in the next 2 or 3 years. Mm-hmm. But it's a nice space, and it could eventually be a rentable back building for a little back house for somebody, garage below and a second floor apartment above. So if you put money into it, you could make it into probably a profitable rental unit, especially with all the new stuff around here.
Yeah.
We've had several offers for it lately, but we just not interested in selling off, dividing the property and selling it off.
Yeah. How would you characterize Cass Corridor when you first moved in?
Oh, it was rough. We didn't really know this until we had already bought the house, but there was a red light district right around the corner from Canfield Street on 3rd Avenue. Yes, there were several bars that were hooker bars for sure, and then others where people, hookers, had staked out various corners that they called their own and that they worked for traffic that came by. It was not uncommon to see large trucks parked around the corner on, not on Cass, but on 3rd Avenue, with their motors running and all locked up. Because the truck drivers knew about this district all across the country, and they would come and leave their motors running so it wouldn't show that they'd turned the car off, the truck off, but they would go in for a quick one in either Anderson's Gardens or the Willis Show Bar or someplace like that. And of course, Mrs. Grohn was a very upstanding lady and did not at all approve of these uses. And in fact, they were quite dangerous and quite bad for the Canfield Street. There was a lot of gunfire down there. The first year that we lived in our house, there were actually 3 murders on the sidewalk in front of our house.
Wow.
They were all connected with the underworld of these prostitute things. Mm-hmm. Somehow we kind of didn't feel threatened by it because we weren't pimps.
Yeah.
And we weren't trying to run some sort of scam over there. But the pimps did kill each other. And so the first year that we lived there, there were 3 occasions in the evening when all the new neighbors, quite a cohesive group in those days, would come out after a murder and wash the blood off the sidewalk and talk to the police about what we'd seen and all that sort of thing. It was, but there were actually 3 on that sidewalk in the first year. After that, it got a lot better. And eventually, Mrs. Grohn's constant pressure finally induced this guy to give up, the guy that owned Anderson's Gardens. So one Christmas day, he called up from Florida, where he lived, to the Glorious Freedom Mission, and he told them that he was donating Anderson's Gardens to the Glorious Freedom Mission, and they could use it for whatever they wanted. And in fact, they made a Sunday school out of it.
It's 180.
Yeah, 180, right? So after he gave up, there was an official Wayne County prosecutor padlock on the other one, the Willis Show Bar, and it lasted for a year, and they never really recovered from that. Between Anderson's Gardens being donated as a Sunday school and the Willis Show Bar being padlocked and sort of declining to almost nothing, the prostitute problem was over, actually.
Yeah.
I won't say that all the prostitutes suddenly disappeared, but they moved away from this area. They went farther down the street, or in fact, they went out to 8 Mile Road.
Mm-hmm.
And the situation eased up quite a lot. It was not in just individual prostitutes either. It was quite organized. They were on a rotating schedule that took them to one city after another under the care of these people who were doing human trafficking, actually. So when it came time for the prostitutes to come to work, a great big limousine would pull up from somewhere in the suburbs and all the girls would get out and go to work. And then they would go back again in the evening. So they didn't, they weren't really free. They were not able to escape, many of them. And of course, there was a constant threat of violence to them. One was murdered. And this was after we had already started a nursery school for some of our children and some of the other Wayne State children. Over in the nursery school met over in the project across the freeway. Not the Brewster, but I'm sorry, I'm blocking on the name of it right now. It'll come to me. The first floor of one of those huge apartment buildings had been changed into a nursery school. It was run partly by Wayne State University and partly by the city. And it had faculty from the Wayne State School of Education. So many of the young faculty members in the chemistry department, there were in fact five families that had young children. We made use of that thing. So we, our children could walk with escort down the block, across the freeway bridge, and into the Brewster, or into the project there, where they would go to nursery school, and then my wife would come back in the afternoon and pick them up and walk them home again. So it was all really pretty convenient.
Yeah.
But the reason I got started on this was because of the murder. One winter, at the end of the winter, the snow and ice was beginning to melt, and the parking lot at the nursery school wasn't draining properly. It was actually ankle deep in water. And so one of our mothers was actually the wife of the general counsel for Detroit. She had some pull with the city. And with this ankle deep water, she and many other people, but also she complained about it. And on her complaint, they acted. They sent out a crew to find out what was blocking the drain. And so they're digging away there and trying to open the drain. And a little bit later, they're reeling back in horror because what they found blocking the drain was the body of a prostitute who had been murdered and stuffed in that drain sometime during the winter. And so the parking lot was cleared.
Yeah.
And all was, well, I won't say all was well again, but that was the kind of thing that could happen in those days around here. It did happen. Another time, there was a child who was murdered and thrown into the dumpster behind, in the alley behind our house. The first thing we know about it is that our children came to us and said, "Mommy, Mommy, can I go see the body in the alley?" And it was, you know, horrifying. In fact, there was a child that had been not, or perhaps a young adolescent, anyway, a small person, had been murdered and put into a black garbage bag and was in the dumpster in the alley with feet sticking out, which I remember seeing vividly. It was just amazing. And it was a person who had disappeared at this stone pool, last known place. In those days, we had a neighborhood swimming pool called the Stone Pool. And she, I think, as I recall, she was abducted or went missing from the stone pool and then was found a few days later with her feet sticking out of this garbage bag.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was rough.
Yeah. When did you get involved with the West Canfield Historic District?
When we bought the house. Mm-hmm. And it, or even before, because we were lobbied rather heavily by Mrs. Grohn to buy this house, which actually didn't belong to her, but to a friend of hers named Margot something. I'll have to look that up. Anyway, she was the owner of record of our house. She didn't own it outright, but she had a land contract on it. And she had put some of her money into it to keep it from being bulldozed.
Okay.
So, because it was scheduled for demolition. And Beulah got these houses, you know, she really saved them from the bulldozer. There were lots of beautiful houses being torn down in Detroit. They didn't really think anything of tearing down a house with beautiful woodwork.
Yeah.
One of the land managers of the city of Detroit was famous for saying, "There's no property in Detroit which is worth, there's no building in Detroit that is worth more than the land under it cleared, with one exception." That exception is the DIA. Other than that, he said, every piece of land in Detroit was worth more clear than with anything on it.
Wow.
Yeah, that was the city.
Grim outlook.
That was the city's attitude toward renewal in those days.
Was it already an official historic district when you moved in?
Yes.
Okay.
Mrs. Grone had created that.
Okay.
Yes.
Then I was reading through her papers at the Reuther before this, and I saw that you'd become president of the association.
Yes, at one point, I think everybody on the block has served as president.
Mm-hmm.
And my turn came about 1975, I guess. We were just starting a big landscape project.
Mm-hmm.
Canfield Street had been a widened street. It was one of the main cross streets in Detroit until the freeways were built.
Mm-hmm.
The freeways cut Canfield Street in two, and it suddenly became nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was no bridge at the end of Canfield Street. All the traffic moved up to Forest or somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Up there, or maybe down to Mac or something. Anyway, what were we talking about?
You becoming president.
Oh yes, right. The street was 100 feet wide, with four lanes on it, and there was no reason for that anymore because it was really not a very well trafficked street at all. So Mrs. Grone had a plans drawn up by some friendly architects who were interested in doing this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Fred Bidigari was his name, I should mention it. He put a lot of time in on this project and made the basic design for it.
Mm-hmm.
The design was to make the street narrow again so that it would be the original width that it was when the houses were first built.
Mm-hmm.
And which meant that there were two rows of trees on either side of the street and a big broad sidewalk going all the way down the middle, of each side, in the front of each side, I should say. And there was also a plan to bring in the cobblestones that had been paving Atwater Street downtown, which had been dug up by the members of West Canfield Society Association at the time that the Remsen was built.
Mm-hmm.
Atwater Street, so all these paving stones that are now on Canfield were originally under the Remsen.
Oh, wow.
Or under where the Remsen is now. And Ford Motor Company gave us some machinery and some trucks and with labor from West Canfield, this was before I lived there, with labor from West Canfield, this great pile of granite paving stones was loaded onto these trucks and carried to Fort Wayne, where they gave us the land to store these paving bricks temporarily, so they said. Yeah. It turned out to be about 10 years. While we rounded up the money to install them on Canfield Street. Oh. And eventually that did happen. And I happened to be president of the association at the time that all that stuff was going on. So we had about $1 million of federal grant money that was eventually spent on Canfield Street to create the streetscape that we now have. Mm-hmm. It didn't all come at once. It started out like with $300,000, and everybody knew that wasn't going to be enough, but never mind. We would just, when we ran out of money, the plan was, we would go to the city council and ask them for another block grant, and so forth and so on. Well, so in the end, I had to be the spokesman for this, and I was the one who went down and sat with the city council and told them about all the cost overruns and how much money we thought it would now cost, and could they find the money, and so forth and so on. So that, Mrs. Groan knew all the city council members personally and had a good friend on the council, by the way. She was a Wayne State professor, Marianne Mahaffey. Mm-hmm. And Mrs. Mahaffey was always there to try to put things forward for us, and she did a very excellent job.
Are you interested in historical preservation before you moved here?
Not particularly, no.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Where we were, there really wasn't much historical preservation. We were in California, everything was reasonably new.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I saw a lot about Canfield West versus Detroit and about a court case with that.
Canfield West and
Detroit about projects going up?
Oh, yes. We were very influential in improving the design of the public housing that was going up adjacent to Canfield Street. Mm-hmm. Because we were a historic district, we had the legal right to review any plans for anything that was going to be put up near us. At one point, the Citizens District Council voted to put up a new 15-20 story high rise at the end of our street, which would have been just exactly the same design as the ones that were across the street, mm-hmm. across the freeway. These were already beginning to deteriorate so badly that actually many of them were demolished. They're, you know, these huge collapses with dynamite and everything. They were already being torn down across the freeway from us, and now the Citizens District Council wanted to build a new one right at the end of Canfield Street. So we used our right of review to object to this. Mm-hmm. And we didn't just object. We also, again, got our friendly architect, Fred Bidigari, and his associates to draw up a plan for another type of city housing, mm-hmm. which was down at the end of the block. And eventually this plan, although it was not under our name for it, because of course they wouldn't ever admit that they'd taken advice from us on anything. But the Citizens District Council was quite hostile to us, as a matter of fact. They were, they considered us to be gentrifiers and interlopers, and they didn't like the idea that blacks were going to lose political control of the city. They were very proud of the fact that they had elected Coleman Young, and there's lots to say about that too. But anyway, there was a lot of pushback to any kind of political moves that we wanted to make. But eventually, reason won out in this case, and they agreed to not build a high-rise, another high-rise at the end of the block, but instead to have low-rise buildings that actually would look compatible with the historic district. Yeah. And my wife's uncle, Irving Bluestone, was at that time a vice president of the United Auto Workers, and he was in charge of General Motors. So he was really a big guy in the city. He also sat on the Michigan Housing Commission. And he was the one who actually got the Housing Commission to increase the amount of money that they were allotting to this new Citizen District Council project. They increased the money by enough so that they were able to buy some more attractive features of this building. They had a nice overhanging eaves and good doors, and you know, a few things that made it wasn't huge, but it made it look a lot better than it would have otherwise. And we've been living reasonably compatibly with this public housing down there. There have always been the occasional dope house down there, mm-hmm. or something like that, but the management is pretty good about cracking down when they find out about it. So it has not been a bad arrangement at all. We live quite happily with them.
Did that animosity towards the gentrification, that continue after that?
Yes, it did. I may be going back a little bit before the actual construction of the Harmony mm-hmm. Place, or whatever it's called, I forget now. One of the times that I had to appear before the city council, there was a council member named Kenny Cockrell, he has a son named Kenny Cockrell, who may be on the council now or recently, but he was very different from his son. He was in a Black Panther, and was extreme. He had the ability to just talk you into a mush of nothing. His mouth would just keep going and keep going and keep going. He was one of those people who could, you know, you see it on television all the time now, but in those, he was the first person I ever knew in person who could just keep talking and run you down until you couldn't answer anything more. And he was very hostile to us. So when I appeared before the city council to ask for more money, he started questioning me. And he asked, had we ever put any of our own money into this project? And I answered yes. Well, not only the houses, which was all private investment, but also we had commissioned the casting of a horse fountain, which was to be installed on the block in front of Mrs. Groan's house is where it ended up. But it was a wonderful piece of work. We collaborated with the Detroit Historical Museum and found a model in the museum of a cast iron horse fountain was missing its bowl on the top, but mm-hmm. otherwise it was a very nice piece of work. Yeah. And we commissioned the Wayne State Sculpture Department, or foundry. In those days, Wayne State had a sculpture foundry.
Oh, wow.
Where they could do bronze castings. They couldn't do iron castings, but they did bronze castings.
That's really cool.
And so we had a replica of this iron horse fountain made in bronze, and the guy who did the casting also created a bowl for it that went very well with it. So he created the bowl and put it on, and we had this very beautiful bronze horse fountain. We asked the city to hook it up to the water so that it would run continuously. Mm-hmm. And it did. It didn't use much water. It was about like a drinking fountain. Mm-hmm. But the water ran continuously, and the bowl kept the bowl filled with fresh water, and then went down the drain at one of the sides. And in those days, the Detroit Police Department actually had horse-mounted officers. Oh. And the stable was somewhere up here near the news center, but the horses worked downtown mostly. So every day there were horses that came by, and they soon found out about our horse fountain. And the horses liked to go there and take a drink, and the officers often let them. So for a few years, we had really a working horse fountain.
Yeah.
that served a purpose. Eventually, the water got disconnected. It wasn't intentional, but we just let it happen because there was some new construction or something that had to be done, and the water dried up. So the horse fountain is still there, and it's used now as a flower pot. But it was for quite a few years a working horse fountain. Yeah. that actually horses came and drank out of.
You were saying the council was asking you about your private investments?
Yes, well, they were asking us if we had put any private investment into it, and I answered yes. Yeah. We put up this horse fountain. And that was not the end of it. He was very abusive to me. I can't even remember exactly what it was that made me so angry with him, but he was calling us gentrifiers, and he was accusing us of throwing old black grandmothers out in the snow and all the usual things that came up that were really totally groundless. I don't think there was a single house on Canfield Street that had anybody living in it when it was bought by the so-called gentrifiers, or the people who live there now. They had all been abandoned. So we were not responsible for throwing anybody out. But this old thing came up again and again. And so after this happened, I had a friend who was a patent lawyer here in town, and he told me about something that had happened that he remembered that had disappeared from public view. It was an incident that occurred on the night of, on election night, the first time that Kenny Cockrell ever stood for election in the city. He was still a Black Panther at that time. And it happened at a place called the Decanter Bar down on Cass Avenue. Everybody was drinking and having a time there on election night, you know, waiting for the results and everything. For some reason, Kenny Cockrell stood up in the back of the bar, and he had a pistol. And he fired several shots into the ceiling. And of course, everybody hit the floor. And then he took his gun and he lowered it, and he fired one shot level across the bar from the back to the front. I'm sure he thought he was firing at a solid wall, but he wasn't. He was firing at a window that had been painted black. And his shot went all the way across the bar, through the window, across the sidewalk, across the street, and it just happened that on the other side of the street there was a man walking along carrying a baby in his arms. And this shot hit the baby.
Wow.
It was fully reported in the Detroit Free Press the next day, along with election results and all that sort of stuff. And of course, Cockrell wasn't elected at that time. Mm. But nevertheless, he had, with his Panther-inspired shooting, he had actually shot a baby. So I went into the archives and I looked up this article to make sure it was there, and it was. Mm. I got a copy of it, and then the next time, so the city was holding open hearings on lighting or something like that. And I went to this open hearing loaded for bear. I had this article in my pocket. And so when it came time for my 3 minutes little speech, I stood up and I told the story of how Kenny Cockrell had shot the baby on election night. No one on the city council was aware of this at the time I told the story. I remember Irma Henderson hunching over with her jaw dropped and her mouth wide open listening to this story, because Kenny Cockrell had been dominating the city council with his motor mouth. Mm-hmm. He was able to get, he would turn on them just as he would turn on anybody. And so after I had finished this story, which I somehow hooked in with the lighting problem, it was time for him to talk. And for the first time in anybody's memory, he was speechless. He really didn't like this. So he, all he said was, Mr. McLean, I have never been convicted of any crime. And I said to him, well, I'm sure you haven't. I said, after all, evasion of the law is your specialty. And everybody knew what I was talking about, because he had gotten a number of famous criminals off from their convictions. He was, that was his basic thing that he could do. I said, I'm sure you weren't convicted. I said, what you can do for your clients, I'm sure you can also do for yourself. But I did say, evasion of the law is your specialty. Well, it took him a while to react, but after the meeting broke up, there was a little barrier, a little fence between the city council and the public. And one of the reporters from the Free Press went up to this little barrier and started asking him questions about it. He was so enraged that he climbed up on the fence and was about to come down on that officer, on that reporter, when the security men for the city council grabbed him and carried him bodily, not on his feet, but carried him back behind the scenes and got him to calm down.
Wow.
He was, and then, yeah, so that was the end of that day. He wanted to renew the debate. He was, after a short time, I received an invitation from somebody on his side to come and debate him about this matter. I wanted to do it, but Beulah and my other people in on Canfield Street said, are you crazy? You don't walk into a lion's den.
Yeah.
You know, when he's prepared for what you know you're going to say. So I never, we dropped it at that. It was, but at least the city council knew that he had this dark secret in his past, and they all heard it, and he didn't last long after that. He was, I won't say this contributed to his death, but he did, he was so such a hyper type A person that it was only about a year or two before he died of a heart attack. And his wife, who was a reasonably good person, and his son, sort of carried on the Cockrell name, and hardly anybody remembers what the old Kenny Cockrell was. They remember the new Kenny Cockrell, who was a very different person. But nevertheless, that was what Canfield Street did to the Black Panthers in those days.
Were you involved with any other preservation organizations in the city?
No, not really.
Okay.
No, we just where we lived.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I saw some other things about like the Concerned Citizens of Cass Corridor and groups.
Well,
like that.
There was that. Yes, we cooperated with them. Many of our members went to their meetings and reported back to us what they were doing. And I went a number of times to that. I'd forgotten about that. The Concerned Citizens of the Cass Corridor, right? Yeah, it was basically an organization that tried to keep the police informed of what was going on, and the police were reasonably helpful in those days. Yeah.
How would you contrast Cass Corridor in the 1970s versus it is today?
Well, it was possible to see a bright future in the old days because of its location and because there was a lot of real estate, a lot of big buildings, I should say, which were not going to be torn down.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, very slowly, all of that did come true. People want to live here now because it is close to the downtown, because there's these big buildings have now been changed into enterprises of various kinds. Lots of new restaurants, lots of even some manufacturing, some sales for big organizations. So yes, I think it was possible to see it, but it sure did take a long time from the mid-70s to, I would say, early 2000s for all of that to come true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What do you think about the new Midtown moniker on the area?
Oh, well, yes, it's the Thought Police will arrest you if you don't refer to it as the Cass Corridor anymore. But I'm happy. The Cass Corridor, was a pejorative term. It became a pejorative term because it had been so far down. And I think it's a good public relations thing to call it Midtown. So I cooperate.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else you wanted to touch on?
Well, it's just that you learn a lot by taking on an old house.
Mm-hmm.
We had to learn to do ornamental plastering, for instance, which is not easy. But a lot of the ornamental plaster in our house was in terrible shape, and in those days we had the energy and the time, I don't know where we got it, to learn to do some of that over, so that although our plastering was not nearly as good as the professionals that had done the original, it was good enough that it didn't stand out horribly. Mm-hmm. And so as we gradually repainted and took the old green paint off of everything on, yes, the Central Baptist Church that owned our house before us had painted everything green, including the mahogany woodwork.
Wow.
So it, one of the few nice things that our house gave us was that when we started taking this paint off, there was not plaster underneath, there was mahogany.
Perfect.
And it was, so we managed to make it back to the way it was about 1913, I guess. The house was built in 1879, and it was a very plain house. Nothing fancy about it at all.
Mm-hmm.
About 1913, some new people took it over, and they are the ones who installed the mahogany woodwork and made it look nice.
Okay.
And the nice fireplaces and stuff like that. So we don't try to sell our house, or we don't try to represent it as a Victorian house. It's really not anymore. It, as a Victorian house, it was very plain. But it's an Edwardian house, I think you would have to say now. The interior is Edwardian rather than Victorian.
Okay. Well, thank you for coming down and talking with me about this.
Well,
it's been very interesting.
Yes, well, it's been an interesting life.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, okay. All right.